Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the legislative session. I'm John Pimble.
The Highway Division is one, of course, that we're all very familiar with. And the Highway Division, of course, focuses on highway maintenance, highway operations, construction design.
Mark Lowe is the director of the Iowa Department of Transportation. In January, he addresses a joint Senate and House Transportation Subcommittee.
We are responsible for what's called the primary system in the state. So the system of interstate highways, U.S. highways, and state highways that comprise the state network of highways is our responsibility, both for maintenance and construction and programming.
Lowe says these make up 8% of the roads in Iowa, but it's where most of the vehicles travel.
So our system becomes a very important, as we say, backbone for the entire state system, and carries a large majority of the traffic that's moving through the state.
Lowe is here to explain the Department of Transportation's budget request. Department heads from the state's larger organizations often do this at committees early in the session.
Whether it's drawn from the primary road fund or the road use tax fund, our operations budget is only what is allocated by the legislature. We don't have the ability to reach into those funds and pull funding out as we see fit.
The amount Lowe is asking for the Highway Division of the Department of Transportation is $259 million for fiscal year 2020. It's about the same as 2019.
A snowplow truck from end to end, that's about 70 feet.
Lee Wilkinson is the Director of Administrative Services Division for the DOT.
We take up a lot of space in our facilities, and so the reality is those garages need to be replaced in Sioux City.
Also in their budget is a one-time $27 million request to replace older garages and offices with one large facility in Sioux City. Wilkinson says the DOT likes to consolidate facilities when they can.
If we were to build both the Hamilton and the Leeds garage separately, just replace them as we do typically with garages, the Hamilton garage would probably cost us in the neighborhood of $11.6 million, and the Leeds garage would cost us in the neighborhood of $14.8 million. So it's a total of $26.4 million for those two garages alone if we were to build them where they're at, because you're obviously building two separate garages, all separate salt storage, cold storage, all the things that go along with it.
Salt, as in what the DOT spreads across the roads when it snows. This presentation was at the end of January, which was right before much of the state received record or near-record amounts of snow in February. This week, Wilkinson has returned to the Capitol as the DOT's budget goes through the final stages. Just before a House subcommittee meets to discuss it, Wilkinson talks about extra money they need now due to the harsh winter.
We have a winter severity index, and on a winter severity standpoint, this has been the highest winter we've had, at least since early 2000s.
Wilkinson says the DOT sets aside $13 million a year for 225,000 tons of salt. Normally, they use 156,000 tons in a season. This year, they've already used around 220,000 tons. Wilkinson says right now, they need to start getting another 124,000 tons to be ready for next winter.
Out of our $13 million salt budget, we would need to spend approximately $8.7 million for salt next year, which would leave us a little over $4 million available for all of next winter to buy salt as we need to, and then ultimately refill our salt sheds, which would not be anywhere near enough.
They are asking the legislature for a supplemental appropriation. That's money to be spent before the new fiscal year.
This winter was sort of a perfect storm, if you will, given the severity of the winter that we faced, plus the fact that we had to actually use a part of our normal salt budget to refill our salt sheds at the beginning of this year because of the previous winter that lasted through the end of April. So we weren't able to get the salt sheds refilled before the start of the fiscal year.
$8.7 million is for this fiscal year to replenish salt.
During the subcommittee, Republican Representative Gary Moore goes through the DOT budget and highlights that the request for more salt is part of fiscal year 2019, not 2020.
Which is a lot of money, it's a lot of salt, but we all know what the winter was like, and we all prefer to drive on safe streets and safe highways rather than ice. And I want to commend the DOT for their wonderful job they did, not only through the snow, but the job they do year-round.
Basically, for the DOT to salt Iowa's roads, they keep their stock as high as possible months before the first snow. When there is a hard winter, they ask for a supplemental budget for more salt around this time of year like they did in 2014. The supplemental budget for salt passes this subcommittee. So does the budget of $404 million for the entire Department of Transportation for 2020. When all of that snow from February started to melt in March, many communities flooded. More than half of Iowa's counties have been approved for a presidential major disaster declaration. The Missouri River runs along much of Iowa's western border. 4 weeks ago, water broke through levees in Mills and Fremont counties. Towns and farms are still submerged. Under that water are roadways. Of the roads where water has receded, it is apparent they will need significant repair if not be completely replaced. What role does the legislature have in funding road repair of this magnitude before they leave this year? Representative Gary Moore says the DOT budget they are approving for 2020 will not take this into account.
Typically, the legislature does not appropriate separate dollars for those types of things. Flood expenses generally come from the federal government through the DOT. They're funded through the Road Use Tax Fund. It's a combination of those existing programs that will be used, so that it's not required that the legislature appropriate additional dollars.
Even with Federal Emergency Relief Association, FERA, or Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, assistance, there can be gaps in funding recovery. Representative Moore says it's too early to tell just how much money from the state will be required.
Until we know what those holes are and what's not being funded, we would probably want to be in that conversation. But at this point, no, we don't have a pot of money just sitting there waiting to be used for that purpose.
Later that day, the full Transportation Committee considers the Department of Transportation Appropriations Bill. Representative Moore expands on the repair of flooded roads.
Western Iowa has been experiencing, is currently experiencing, tremendous floods. Interstate 29, Highway 34, Highway 2 have incurred what we expect to be rather extensive damage. But quite honestly, we're not able to know all of the damage because a lot of those roadways are still submerged underwater. And so until we can get at those, until the DOT can get at those facilities to know exactly what damage has been done and what the costs are, we don't know it at this point.
When asked about a future supplemental appropriation, Representative Moore reiterates that decision will be made when they know more about the damage and what kind of federal assistance is available. This budget passes the committee and can be debated in the full House. It already passed in the Senate unanimously. The Department of Transportation is just one of many departments that will require flood relief funding in the months to come. This fiscal year ends in June, and it's likely to end with a surplus. Governor Reynolds says she is meeting with legislators in this final month of the session to determine what to do right now.
Well, we're going to act while they're here. I mean, that would be, you know, of course we'll do that while they're still in session. So we'll have an opportunity to sit down. We're working through what that looks like, what we feel is the potential need based on, you know, the declaration that we got from the President disaster declaration was $1.6 billion. And, you know, honestly, that's probably low as we move forward with this and as we start to look at some of the severity and the breaches. I mean, one breach alone was anywhere from 62 to 72 feet deep and 400 to 500 yards long. So, I mean, this is significant. And so it is a short term and then long term. And even when I talk about short term, it is plugging the hole, trying to sustain it so that we're 2 feet above water so that we can empty out the water that's still standing and then try to get in there and figure out what we need to do next.
Although it is April, more snow is on the way from the Midwest, which means rivers, lakes, and streams are likely to rise again. And that's not including what kind of spring rain may come ahead. Flooding in Iowa and its effects will be felt through much of this year. This is the weekly legislative podcast, Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble. We're in the last few weeks of this legislative session. While floor debate will include policy bills that have passed through committees, more budget bills are showing up. One that includes giving money to many departments is the Infrastructure Appropriations Bill. It appropriates $111 million that comes from the Rebuild Iowa Infrastructure Fund, or RIF, and the Technology Reinvestment Fund. It helps departments across the state to make improvements, repairs, and enhancements. Part of it will give $4.3 million to renovate part of the campus for the Iowa School for the Deaf in Council Bluffs. Another gives $5 million over 2 years to renovate the 4-H building at the State Fair. And one that has gained attention concerns the Iowa Historical Building.
We talk a lot about every year on infrastructure about routine maintenance, that if we don't keep up with it, it becomes major maintenance. And if we don't do that, it becomes replacement.
Democratic Representative Dennis Cahoon speaks on the House floor about the historical building troubles that started after it opened in 1987.
The building itself cost $26 million. So if we're going to rehab that, we're talking about spending almost twice as much possibly to rehab it as it did to originally build it.
There are many problems with the building, and a recent estimate to fix it comes in at $50 million. This high price tag led legislators like Cahoon and Representative Gary Moore to look at other options, like how much would a new building cost?
Didn't we have a figure of a beginning figure of $125 million, I thought?
That number has been, I've heard that number. That's what, as I understand it, was expended in the state of Tennessee to build a new state historical museum. Okay. I don't know by our standards here in Iowa. For example, if the decision's made to relocate to the state fairgrounds, we may not have to buy property. That $125 million may or may not have included cost of land. And so there's a lot of factors I don't think we know today.
$50 million to fix the current building, $125 million to build a new one downtown, relocate the museum, and build out the Iowa State Fair. These are options that Moore, Cahoon, and others have been talking about as a possibility for the state historical building. But that's a lot of money. To understand this complicated problem, this infrastructure appropriations bill establishes a task force with a budget of $1 million.
And that a task force of the following individuals be created to take a look at these options. One member appointed by the Iowa State Fair Board, one member appointed by the Iowa State Fair Foundation, one member appointed by the Department of Administrative Services, one member who's designated by the General Assembly as the facilities manager for facilities under the control of the General Assembly, one member appointed by the Director of the Department of Cultural Affairs, one member appointed by the Governor, and then we would have members appointed by the majority and minority leaders in the House and the Senate. And again, the purpose of that, I think it's 10 people, would be to take a look at the state fairgrounds as an option, or other possibilities as an option. What would it cost to build? That would be the purpose of that group.
This group of individuals are required to make an interim report in December of this year and have until 2021 to make their final recommendation to the legislature. This means the solution for the historical building is a couple of years away. The infrastructure appropriation bill passes 100-0.
House File 759 is our fiscal year 2020 admin and regs budget.
Republican Representative John Landon floor manages the Administration and Regulation Appropriations Bill.
It would appropriate $52.4 million in general fund dollars, and it would also approve $55.38 million from revolving funds and various other funds.
Mostly it's for, as stated in the bill, salaries, support, maintenance, and miscellaneous purposes. It also says how many full-time equivalent positions it funds, or FTEs. Here are just a few departments in the bill for the Secretary of State. It gives $2.1 million for administration and elections with 16 FTEs, $6.4 million and 50.7 FTEs for Racing and Gaming Commission, and $1 million with 17.25 FTEs for Alcoholic and Beverages Division. For the last 2 years, there was a revenue shortfall, but that's not the case this year. Still, very few departments are seeing an increase.
Most of the departments and agencies requested status quo, and that's what we're approving.
There are exceptions. Department of Administrative Services requested $168,000 more to pay for utilities to state buildings. They also requested $500,000 for this year as supplemental appropriations to cover a budget shortfall for increased utilities. The governor's office is also requesting more.
We've also approved two new FTEs for the governor's office for a total of $200,000 that the governor's office tells us they would use that as an analyst for tax policies and another analyst for health care policies. There would also be a $48,000 increase for Terrace Hill Quarters.
That increase for the governor's office angers Democratic Representative Karen Derry.
The proposed $200,000 increase would represent a 9.5% increase in dollars and a 10.5% increase in FTEs for the governor's office. And even though I serve on the Administration and Regulation Appropriations Subcommittee, I have received no details about why these two positions are needed. In fact, the information that Representative Landon just shared about there being analyst positions is the first that I've heard that.
Representative Derry says a subcommittee meeting for this bill ended abruptly, and discussions with departments affected by this bill were not part of further committees.
Even though I am a member of this appropriations subcommittee, no one ever asks for my input on this bill. And that is disappointing to this freshman legislator who has talked with countless voters about the importance of Republicans and Democrats working together. Voters in my district did not send me here to have me shut out of discussions and decision-making just because I'm a member of the minority party.
Democratic Representative Bruce Hunter was also part of the subcommittee. Hunter says he also objects to the lack of time this bill had in subcommittee. He claims department heads were not comfortable with questions like the Secretary of State when asked about publishing proposed constitutional amendments or how to make sure the new voter ID requirement is being shared with voters.
Because I believe it is our role to ask the questions of those department heads to see where that money is being spent that we allocate and to make sure that that money is being spent as we so desire. I will continue to be asking these types of questions, not only the Secretary of State, but to all budget subs that come before admin and reg as long as I'm there, because it is my duty.
Representative Hunter says because he didn't have this dialogue in a subcommittee, which is open to the public, the administration and regulation budget is flawed.
Because we didn't get a chance to ask the tough questions of those department heads, because supposedly it would make them uncomfortable. Get a backbone. Or suck it up, Buttercup, I don't know which. Ladies and gentlemen of the body, I would urge you, because of the flaws in this budget and because of the flaws in this process, that you vote no on House File 759. And we start over and ask the tough questions.
But Representative John Landon says every member of this committee was free to research the spending in this bill.
To go to those departments, tour those departments, speak to those directors, speak to those employees, and find out what they're doing, and that isn't happening. And so the onus is on all of us to do better. It's not for one party. This isn't a divisive bill. This isn't a divisive subject. It's for us to all dig in and do our work. Many of us have spent countless meetings and hours with departments and agencies to get their budget right, to find out what they're doing, and it shouldn't be one party doing that.
This budget bill passes on a 54-46 vote. The next stop for this bill is a five-member Senate subcommittee panel that will be chaired by Republican Senator Dennis Guth on a date that is to be scheduled soon. This is the weekly legislative podcast Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble. It's not often you see the president of the Senate leading a subcommittee panel, but Republican Senator Charles Schneider chairs an appropriations subcommittee for a bill changing the minimum age to use tobacco from 18 to 21.
It also does include an exception for people who have a military ID, so military active people who are currently serving would be exempt.
Much of the bill revises the current law, which requires a person to be 18 or older to use tobacco or vape products. Mike Triplett is a lobbyist for Iowans for Alternatives to Smoking and Tobacco, or IFAST. He also lobbies for the Vapor Technology Association. He says electronic cigarettes and regular cigarettes that burn should not be placed in the same category and shouldn't be prohibited by people between the age of 18 and 20.
We think this is a distinct opportunity for this state to differentiate between combustible cigarettes, which have killed millions of people in our country for the last however long, and e-cigarettes, which are proving to be a much more reliable way to get people off of smoking.
Travis Pulse, owner of Atmosphere Vapors in Grinnell, is opposed. He says vaping has helped many in his community to quit smoking.
And while I feel that this bill is well-intentioned, I firmly believe it would have negative impacts on tobacco harm reduction efforts in our state. As someone who personally struggled with addiction in my teenage and early adult life, I understand the setbacks and obstacles addictions can suddenly place in front of young Iowans.
But Danielle Oswell Toll from American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network doesn't think e-cigarettes are any better. Oswell Toll opposes the bill because of some of its language about e-cigarettes.
I'd like to focus on our concern around the fact that the bill does not include language that would include electronic smoking devices in the definition of tobacco products. We want to ensure that e-cigarettes are regulated with parity by all evidence-based tobacco control laws, and they currently are not, because of the definitions that were passed before this bill was brought forth. Our goal is to improve upon the current bill, and we are asking to be a part of the solution.
Stacy Freeland from the American Heart Association also opposes the bill.
A lot of times people call these things vaping products, but really, it's aerosol that it's emitted, and there is chemicals that are within that. And there are serious kinds of conditions that you can get from these types of chemicals that are in these, lung disease, heart disease, cancer, certain types of cancer. A lot of the same chemicals you'll see on another page, the same chemicals that are in cigarettes are also in e-cigarettes. So don't be fooled. It's still dangerous.
Freeland also says the bill needs steeper penalties for people selling tobacco to minors.
Right now, the first offense for selling tobacco is $300. For selling alcohol, it's $500. Then you go up to the second offense. It's a 30-day suspension and $1,500 for alcohol. But for tobacco, it's $1,500 fine or a 30-day suspension.
There are some from the e-cigarette and vaping industry here that support the bill, like Juul Labs. They manufacture e-cigarette devices and the chemicals containing nicotine that come in what are called pods. Genevieve Plumador lobbies for Juul Labs.
And we share a common goal with policymakers, regulators, parents, school officials, and community stakeholders. Prevent the use of tobacco and vapor products, including Juul, by America's youth. We are committed to stopping youth access of Juul products, and no young person or non-nicotine user should ever try a Juul.
Democratic Senator Joel Bolcom is one of the three members of this subcommittee panel. He says the heart of this matter is nicotine addiction in burning or vaporized forms.
Who can be against raising the age, right?
You can.
But it's not going to do a darn thing to reduce the use of these highly addictive products to our youth, and that's really what we ought to be talking about today. And I'd be happy to talk to you, Mr. Chairman, about ideas to improve this bill by way of some parity around tobacco products on smoke-free air taxation and stricter penalties. And our health department, and our attorney general, we need a much more robust effort around reducing the use of these products. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks.
Republican Senator Tom Shipley says this bill, like many others in a subcommittee, always need to be refined. but he supports this effort.
But I think this is a start down the path. I think this is a start towards getting some kind of effects, and I am not naive enough to believe we're going to stop it all. I know that. I've been around kids and people enough to know that's not going to happen. But I'd like to see, and people have said, you've already stepped out and said you want to help make it better. Many of you have. So that being the case, why, whether we get it done for this legislative session or not, but it certainly is alive for, could be alive for next year to be worked on. And it's going to take some work. I get it. But I'd like to see it move forward.
Republican Senator Charles Schneider and author of this bill says this kind of legislation is part of a national trend.
By my count, there were 11 states and the District of Columbia who've increased the minimum purchase age for tobacco and e-cigarettes in one form or another, either to 19 or 21, and most are to 21. And I say this afternoon because it seems like this is changing at a very rapid pace, and tomorrow morning there could be another couple of states added to that list.
Senator Schneider says his district has some of the state's largest high schools.
And I've been hearing more and more from parents and teachers about kids in high school who are using particularly vape products and that it's becoming an epidemic. Statistics have been cited to show that the use of vape products among high school students has increased significantly just within the past year. And to the point about the pipeline, the fact is that the statistics I've seen show that 80% of high school students turn 18 before they graduate from high school. So they can legally buy vape and tobacco products, bring them back to the schools, share them with friends, sell them to friends, however they get them distributed, it's a part of that network, a part of that pipeline. I've also seen a statistic that shows that 90% of the adults who buy tobacco products for kids under 18 are themselves only 19 or 20, 90% of them. So if those statistics are true, then you follow the logic, increasing the minimum age for purchasing tobacco and vape products to 21 can significantly help us disrupt that pipeline and help us take a step to keep these products out of the hands of high school kids.
The three senators in this appropriations subcommittee signed this bill, and it can advance to a full committee. It is toward the end of the session in a committee that technically allows it to be considered till nearly the last day. If it doesn't advance much further in 2019, it is likely legislative leaders will try again in 2020. This is the weekly legislative podcast Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble. Last year, a judge tossed out a federal law banning the practice of female genital mutilation nationwide. The ruling states it is up to states to prosecute such crimes. The Iowa Senate passed a bill earlier this session that does this. This week, it also passed in the House, but the House added an amendment that contains educational components. It's designed to reach out to Iowans who come from cultures where female genital mutilation is common. Because the House passed it with an amendment, it will need to come before the Senate for another discussion. If they approve the changes, it can be considered by the governor to be signed into law. Week 13 of the session means there are 13 weeks of stories on our website by our Statehouse reporter, Katerina Sestarik. Some of her work also helps this show. Collaborations with Radio Iowa's Kay Henderson are also of great help to this show and pretty much every single reporter working at the Capitol. Story guidance and script editing comes from Iowa Public Radio News Director Michael Leland. I did say this is week 13, and that means there are 12 other episodes of Under the Golden Dome available. Should you wish to binge listen, you can start by going to iowapublicradio.org or find us through podcast distributors like iTunes. If you subscribe, you'll see the latest episode pop up in your feed when we release a new show every Friday. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.